Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends, but the truth is he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as so he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Matt Sweeney is a gifted guitarist, producer, and songwriter based in New York City. Originally from New Jersey, Sweeney first came to prominence in the 1980s band Skunk, and then later as a member of the inventive rock band Chavez, whose 1995 album Gone Glimmering was recently given the 25th anniversary reissue treatment by Matador Records. In the years and decades after Chavez stopped working together on a regular basis, Sweeney wound up playing live with Guided by Voices, Swan, and Iggy Pop, and was called upon to lay guitar down on records by Johnny Cash, Cat Power, Adele, the Dixie Chicks, Neil Diamond, Run the Jewels, Andrew W.K., and Stephen Malcolmus, among many others. He has also produced records for the likes of Dave Grohl, Baby D, Turbo Negro, and Sung Hoi Blues. And he also hosted the entertaining web TV series Guitar Moves, which found him interviewing and jamming with people like Keith Richards, Dean Ween, James Williamson, and St. Vincent, to name just a few. If all of that wasn't enough, Sweeney has a long and fruitful collaborative history with Will Oldham, as the two good friends have been making music together for more than two decades, including their acclaimed 2005 album, Superwolf, and again recently for a spate of singles released by Drag City Records. Matt and I recently connected for a wide-ranging chat about many of the aforementioned things and people, what The Sopranos might tell us about his own upbringing in New Jersey, America's anti-hero worship issues, the connection between The Monkees, Neil Young, and Jimi Hendrix, why we should reassess the band Sha-na-na, his relationships with LP and Will Oldham, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, and Massey Hall's concert film series live at MasseyHall.com, where you can stream dozens of 30-minute films for free, including performances by past podcast guests like A.C. Newman of the New Pornographers. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 591st episode of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Matt Sweeney, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Those expensive things, and I OD'd in Denver, and wish I could remember her name. Hi, Matt. How's it going?
Hi, Vish. I don't know. How's it going with you?
The same. It's, we're happy new year, if I might say. Why don't we start with that?
Well, is it? Where are you?
No, I'm in Alberta, Canada.
I'd love to know where a happy new year is. Tell me, where are you at?
I am calling you from Edmonton, Alberta. It is, as we're speaking, it is not quite. It's December 31st. But by the time people hear this, it will be 2021. So I thought I would start with a nice Happy New Year greeting. But no, you and I are in the same year still. We are still in 2020. Unless, where are you?
We are. Well, now I can understand why, since you're calling from Canada, why it is a happier New Year than it is in America. So I wish you a Happy New Year, and I don't want to put the pressure on you to have to wish us a happy new year, because that would be like wishing somebody a happy death.
Yeah. It is a little bleak. Absolutely. First of all, where in the world are you today, Matt?
I'm in New York City on St. Mark's Place.
Nice. And that's where you live, I assume? I can't keep track of your comings and goings. You're always moving around and working with people. Are you in New York generally?
I'm generally in New York, yes.
Yes. And how long have you been there?
I was born here, and then I grew up in New Jersey and dicked around in New York, and I don't know, forever. since 1990 or some shit.
Okay.
Like I've been living in New York, or living in or around New York, or basically thinking of New York as home.
So you consider yourself a New Yorker more than someone from New Jersey, a New Jerseyite, I suppose?
I don't know. You tell me. I've been here since 1990, but I'll tell people that I'm from New Jersey, because when they say, where am I from? I was just raised to say where I was from.
Yeah.
For some reason, I talk about my childhood. So my childhood was in Jersey, but then I left home when I was like 17. So yeah.
But then
I did the usual post college fuck around and crashed back in my dad's house for like a year at some point when I was 19 or 20. But and then I started crashing in New York. So whatever. I in fact enjoy people thinking that I'm from New Jersey because then I don't have to talk to you about New York. And I like enjoy people thinking I'm from New York, so I don't have to talk to them about New Jersey.
There's some regional friction between Jersey and New York on some level, isn't there? Or is that a myth?
I think it's perceived as such by outsiders. It's actually pretty. That's actually a myth. Although you know, it's as much of a myth as a city versus a suburb myth. Or you know what I mean? It's just like everybody from in New York City. Generally, if they're not from New York City, they seem to be. Or I don't know. There's a huge New Jersey contingent in New York City, and there always fucking has been.
Yeah.
And generally, when you look at iconic New Yorkers, half of them are from New Jersey. So it's kind of like it's not as much of a thing. I wish there actually was more sort of regional friction. It would be fun. It would be interesting.
You often hear that people from who work in New York City live in places like Connecticut. But now that I think of it, people also tend to commute in from New Jersey. I mean, that it's just people don't want to live right in New York City. You live right in New York City. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not commuting. Yeah. You're not. So, I mean, on some level, New Jersey, Connecticut could be viewed like little suburbs, little outskirts of New York City for some people. But you don't. Is that wrong?
Well, yeah. Because Vish, they are. That's it. Suburbs were invented. They were called suburbs, and they were in New Jersey and Connecticut in order for people to work in New York. So guess what? You'd be right.
That's right.
But they call them bridge and tunnel people, but there's every city has a version of bridge and tunnel people,
yes,
I imagine.
That's what I'm kind of getting at. Yeah, for sure. Yes. I'm actually, as we're speaking, I have reimmersed myself in the world of The Sopranos. I started rewatching The Sopranos, so I have a lot of Jersey, New York on my mind. So maybe that's why.
That's exactly. I'm from Tony. My dad taught at Seton Hall University, the school that the character of Tony Soprano went to. You know, when he talks about Seton Hall, that's my dad's school. Like, I am from that region, the Sopranos region.
I see.
I went to high school with a lot of kids who were like the young Soprano, like Anthony Soprano.
When you say like Anthony, you know, AJ, do you mean really like
sons of gangsters? Yes.
Really, like, are they? So this is all based on some. We were talking about myths earlier, but you, this was common knowledge in your school that certain kids, you probably don't want to mess with them.
I mean, yeah, it's, you know, it's not, yeah, it's like any, I guess it's like any place else. You just know that you don't fuck with kids. To me, it's not. I wasn't like, oh, they're gangsters and blah blah blah, and they're gonna, you know, and there's, you know, I just. It's just more about how they looked and how they behaved. And then as I grew older, I came to understand what was actually going on. But at the time, it wasn't like, oh, you know, don't fuck with that kid. He's a gangster. It was just more like, those guys are dicks. Why are they such fucking dicks? You know, like, and then I go, oh, right. Okay, now I get it. You know, but, you know, by the same token, some of them were cool. I don't know.
Were you a guy?
It was funny. That opening sequence, I was like, oh yeah, that's like outside of my window driving when I was a kid, you know.
Oh.
like so my mom lives in Hoboken, you know, so whatever. I guess it's probably hard to describe. I'm not going to try to describe New Jersey and New York because so many people have done a better job than me, and we're only on a podcast.
but you say, just to tie this up, you
sure
vaguely relate. The Sopranos is vaguely realistic in a sense, or at the very least you relate to
utterly real.
It is
utterly realistic.
Huh.
I mean, in my opinion, as far as like gangsters, criminals acting like criminals. Yeah. It's pretty fucking accurate.
Right. You know? Right. Okay.
You know, I really like that show. It's really interesting to, you know, I watched it when it was out, when I was a young person. You know, I was in my 20s when that show first came out, and it was pretty exciting because I was like, oh my god, this was, you know, I was like, this is about the fucking people that I know, this is what they were up to. You know. But then watching it now, it really holds up more, just the corrupting influence and how I wasn't aware. The show is basically about how these people ruin everybody's lives.
Yes.
In order to get their dick sucked, you know, basically, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah,
and it's in such high relief when you're, at least the second time around I watch it, just all of, you know, Artie Bucco, but everybody is sort of treated like Artie Bucco, ultimately. You know what I mean? Like, you know, everybody is you. Everybody's lives are diminished by coming into contact with these criminals, you know? So in some ways, it's fun. It's also fun watching it in the Trump era, you know, like now that this kind of behavior is now in the government, you know what I mean? And it's accepted as such, you know?
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it's the idea of something happened post Reagan where the idea of like looking after number one became synonymous with American values. And that really was not the case prior to Reagan. Looking after number one was synonymous with American villainy, you know, like the boss man, the evil capitalist boss man, you know, character and thing had existed since the late, you know, whatever, since the industrial age, you know, like people have been taking advantage of poor people in America. But Reagan brought a new thing in which is like, no, it's good to take advantage of people, you know, like you're a fucking asshole unless like you should get what you want and fuck the poor people. And because they're stupid, you know, and like, it's all about me. It's all number one, you know, like get the money and that's the thing. And so then criminals became like, when Scarface came out, I was in high school and I was like, okay, this is a black comedy. This is like a racist comedy, you know, like that I thought was interesting, you know, but it's like, you know, and by racist, I mean like how they portray Cubans.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And I mean, one thing I would have never, ever in a million years guessed is that the character of Tony Soprano would be perceived as a hero.
Yeah.
Ever. You know what I mean? That's the last thing I could have ever dreamed when that movie came out. You know, I mean, and again, I was a privileged, you know, suburban white kid. So it was beyond my imagination that anybody would think that this was cool. But I still hold that I still think of it as a post-Reagan vibe. We've been living in a post-Reagan vibe. And the idea that, again, what's so cool about The Sopranos is like the first episode, you're like, oh, wait a minute, I can relate to this guy. He's, you know, this show's amazing because it's about work. You know, it's about trying to run a business. You know, it's about trying to get things done, and everything is sort of like, you know, like that. Part of the brilliance of the show is that you relate to this guy at the beginning,
right?
And then slowly you're like, wait a minute, this guy's a fucking, you know, the worst dude ever.
Yeah.
And all of this is the worst shit ever. You know what I mean? And I really think that it's all of the like the era that we're in. Sopranos is a very relevant thing. Scarface is very relevant. It's all relevant to understanding, I think, an American way of thinking that really is something that happened in the 80s. It happened with Reagan.
Well,
you know what I mean?
I would say there's at least two things swimming around in what you're saying. You're saying, mm-hmm. you know, this show that I very casually invoke this show, but you're right. It does resonate with what's going on, particularly mm-hmm. in your country. But I would argue a couple of things. One, I feel mm-hmm. like the brazenness of this sort of behavior is what's a bit different. I would argue that the things you're describing did occur pre-Reagan, post-Reagan. But I think
it
was always lurking in the shadows. And the second thing I will say is that for some reason in our culture in particular, and maybe it happens globally, we really need to maybe re-examine our relationship with the anti-hero. Because
for sure.
Anti-hero worship has been going on for decades. When I think of all like the film studies classes I took when I was in high school and university, and we delved into film noir and all sorts mm-hmm. of, you know, those sorts of characterizations of kind of mm-hmm. shady business. And then you look at what we've been celebrating and immersing ourselves in collectively pre-Trump, post-Trump, Breaking Bad, Sopranos, Game of Thrones,
Mad
Men. These are not like if you're talking about TV and film, Tarantino films, we should not like these people. They're not good.
I know, these people all fucking stuck. I'm totally with you. And you're right. It's the brazenness. And that's what I mean about the Reagan thing. And I guess I wasn't clear because, again, the character of the fucking evil boss exploiting people, you know, that's a thing, you know, like there's an amazing folk song called I Hate the Capitalist System from like the 30s, you know, mm-hmm. you know, and just breaking it down. Obviously, we all know these stories, you know, but you're correct. It's the brazenness. And it went from being in I think, in the cultural mind. Yeah, we all got to stick together because there are these fuckers who have a lot of money. And we got to fucking keep them in check. You know what I mean? Like they're, you know, like we have a system that can be abused and so people have to sort of band together for the greater good, you know, for the kid, for young people and for old people and for weak people and for, you know, people who need help. We got to stick together because the powers that be don't care about us. And so, you know, I really agree. I've been thinking about this. Both my parents were public servants. My mom's a judge. My dad was a university professor, you know. But like they were cool and they're mellow and nice and let me do what I want and stuff. But the whole idea there was just the don't be a fucking gross asshole thing was definitely a vibe, you know, I was growing up and like. And again, yeah, the brazenness, the celebrating. That's why I was using the Tony Soprano thing and how unprepared I was for what he came to stand for. And yes, it is. It's all about this thing about celebrating the individual, you know, and even like the noir. And I agree with you, like the noir thing, the anti-hero. It's like, you know, yeah, but the reason that these noir guys are anti, we're not supposed to think that they're cool. They're fucked up, you know, like mm-hmm. like a lot of these characters are meant to be, it's meant to be understood that they've been fucked up by the war and they can't even handle it. You know what I mean? That's like an unspoken thing about, you know, about that. And even like something like the Beats and just this whole idea of the individual, you know, fucking everybody over or like, you know, like all about me. That's also very like kind of a Beats thing or a Kerouacian thing, you know? But again, sure. if you read On the Road, the last time I read it, I was like, "Oh my god, this is all about post-war trauma," and nobody had ever like suggested that, you know. But like to me at least, you know, I just never had a professor ever be like, "Yeah, read this book, understand that all the characters are super traumatized, and that there's stuff they can't deal with and they can't think about because of the war."
Right.
You know,
right?
And like if you read it that way, it's really good. You know what I mean? And kind of empathetic and makes more sense than, oh, these guys are really cool. You know,
I will reread that. I did not.
Yeah. Check it. Read it with that thing. And it's really fascinating in that way. And to me, a much better book, you know, if you read it.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. There's a lot about powerlessness there too, in terms of, you know, gross people asserting themselves. You know, in The Sopranos, as I'm rewatching it for the millionth time, but I just started season two. But there is a real clear depiction of police and government corruption as well. That often goes hand in hand with these depictions. It's not just that. You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. But I think one thing that's changed is like. Here's the thing. It's like it used to be like, yeah, we know that the government can be, the corruption always exists. You know what I mean? Like that's just an understood thing. That's human nature. But it went from like, we have to protect ourselves against corrupt people to like, we should all be corrupt.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's like,
well, we're rooting for heels. Like I remember watching Breaking Bad. And quite quite enjoying that show, but you know the last time I tried to watch it, I was too stressed out. I found it too anxiety inducing. But you do find yourself rooting for the meth lab kingpin guy over his good natured, honorable cop. So that says something. I mean, I think that's what I was doing. I think that's what we're meant to do. So that's and so then isn't the logical conclusion that if Americans are immersed in these kinds of narratives day in day out. This guy, a guy like Trump comes along, you're going to want to...
Totally!
It's like voting for the bad guy and cheering
on
because he's sort of more interesting than the straight and narrow. So we're voting for things that we find interesting.
That we like.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we don't even like them.
Sensational things.
Yeah. The sensational. So that's where I your country and ours probably too is in a terrible state that way. And I'm not ever... someone who's like, we got to examine the media. You know, when
right.
I'm not like
right.
Tipper Gore or something. I'm just saying
right.
Well, we've just been immersing ourselves in culture in this regard. I would even say hip hop music. Like I grew up loving hip hop music and I viewed that
right.
as aspirational music. Like,
right.
yes, finally,
right.
this is like
yeah.
reparations, in fact, to get yours.
Yeah.
But now I'm on the
yeah.
other side of like, isn't Trump the ultimate avatar of some of that materialistic, misogynistic? Like now I'm like very confused. Like what have I been immersing myself in and celebrating my whole life? You know,
right.
like, so then I'm like reexamining my, anyway, sorry, this is, it's
a lot.
It's
yeah,
a lot
no,
to
no,
unpack.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. And again, from the perspective of somebody like I'm somebody who was lucky and had a lot of things provided for me. So you know, my needs, so many of my needs were met. So, you know, it took me, I had to gain an understanding of the good minded criminal. Or I don't know how to put it, but you know, it took me a minute to really understand why you had to live outside the law and how fucking wretched law enforcement is. And, you know, and again, I grew up luckily I grew up around people who weren't like me my whole life, you know, but still I didn't know shit. You
yeah.
know what I mean? I still don't know shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I keep on going, oh my God, I can't believe that I didn't get it, you know?
Yeah.
And I guess but get it is, you know, me understanding exactly how privileged I was and really the full degree of how much it sucks to be to not be white, you know, is something I've been aware of all my life, but I'm only just more and more aware of it. You know?
Yeah.
And it sucks.
Yeah.
You know,
but
also I agree as far as like I've talked to really incredible people who all of a sudden will like dig the Trump vibe because it has something to do with, yeah, he's a gangster. He goes for his. And it's like, no, stop. No.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because no matter how you cut it, that kind of shit ends up hurting people. It does.
Being
looking after number one and treating the world like it's a fucking, like it's a rat race and that, you know, it's go for yours and out for self and all this kind of shit. And again, you know, I don't know. That shit sucks. It just ends up sucking.
Well,
you know?
I'm not a new parent. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. So you end up encountering a lot of what we're discussing just talking to them, like this sort of rationalization of selfishness. Like, I did this because of this. And you know, I've engaged in that behavior too. Like you're talking about reassessments or sort of like, maybe understanding your place in the world and maybe what your behavior means to other people. And that's a positive aspect of maybe what's going on culturally in terms of people stopping to self-examine, you know, self-care and self-examine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's
right.
that's good. But there is this rationalization of assholery. Like, it really stems from, I think, the way we've immersed ourselves in certain kinds of culture and sort of, I think some of us have been like, well, that's a character or that's a performance or that's a fiction. You know, I'm not,
right.
I don't assume that people would actually behave that way. And now we're living through
right.
a phase where people took it literally. Like, oh, I can't.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah. So that's why it's really, the disconnect is real because it is a separation of reality. It is a conflation of popular culture, fiction, and reality that doesn't work.
Doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
And again, if you have motherfuckers who watch, or that's me. But if you have people who watch TV all the time, people like you know, and I have somebody that I love that's in mind, you know, a colleague that I love, but and dude has always watched TV. You know what I mean? And look at where TV's gone, and of course, you know, he got infected with Foxism. You know what I mean?
Mm.
But Foxisms are based on heelisms. You know what I mean? Are based on this idea of like the American heel being right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah,
and it's all based on believing shit that from television narratives, from stupid fucking television narratives.
Yeah,
You know what I mean? And it's a fact. That is a fucking fact. I do it too. We all do it. You know what I mean? We all of our values are pretty screwed up because of, we watched a shit ton of TV, you know, and it's like,
I don't want to sound like an old man, but I feel like there are aspects of the television wasteland that I had growing up. I think you and I are probably around the same age.
And I'm 51.
Okay. So you've got some years. I just turned 43. We're close. So TV definitely had some filler. I mean, the whole time I've been watching TV, there was stuff that just was like, all right, it's Sunday. I'm going to watch A&E Biography all day or whatever the hell. But I would argue that, and again, I don't mean to sound like an old, out of touch person. It used to be a little more substantive, perhaps, and now it's very stylized. Like, all the stuff mm-hmm. that people talk about is pretty, like, gross, like, superficial shit. And I don't necessarily, I knew that was there, and I would avoid it.
Right.
But it just seems like that's what ends up pervading our collective conversations more. Like, I've never seen the show The Bachelor. I've never watched reality TV.
Me neither, right.
But reality TV, like, my son is into it now. Like, everything, he doesn't watch those shows, but he's so immersed in sort of the way culture is now that when he leaves a computer screen or a TV screen, everything's a competition. Everything has to be something where it's an adversarial relationship where who's going to eat dinner the fastest? I'm like, Levon, that's not just because you watched that game show or they turned that concept into a game show. Not all of life is a game show. But now you got a game show host as a leader of the free world.
Yep.
That's going to pervade like very competitive, selfish, I need to win at all costs kind of behavior. And I feel like that's where we're at right now. And
it's so brutal.
It is bad.
I know it really sucks. I am an old out of touch person, so it's fine. I could say anything I want. But like that just really is the case. And of course we could just, you know, and if we're going to stay on that, you know, I don't know if you watched that Mr. Rogers documentary, but ain't no way you're not going to be bawling when you watch it, you know, and like it's,
that is why my wife and I keep seeing it show up as a thing we can watch.
And you don't want to cry.
She's like, I know I'm going to cry. She said that every time I will cry.
And it's ultimately worth it though, because that, and that's the thing that I found is like, I got to still like, it's good to check those things out because you see, it's like, you could cry that it's not there anymore, but it's like, yeah, but still this was a completely underdog thing. And this is about being clear. And also like, let's make no mistakes about it. It's always been pretty fucking awful. There's always been something this bad.
Yes.
You know what I mean? There's always been some version of something this bad, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Look at, you know, you look at the '60s and what was going on, civil rights. It's thousands of people with signs with the N word on it. It's screaming and trying to throw rocks at children. You know what I mean? It's like, we've edged a little bit away from that, you know what I mean? But it's like, it's always been there. It's always fucking been there. It's always been awful. You know what I mean? So it's important to see, like when you watch, I would recommend watching the Mr. Rogers thing. Cause you're like, oh, right. It's not like everything was better then. It was that things were really sucky. Things were really sucky. And this guy did something good. You know what I mean? And that's important and that's why it's important to watch these things. It's like, because I also did the same thing. I put off watching for those reasons. Like, I don't want to cry. I don't want to fucking think about how great things used to be. It's not about that, you know?
Well, I interviewed the comedian Sashir Zameda a few years ago, and we were talking about, at the time, this was way before the Black Lives Matter movement had really picked up the national or international profile. But she was saying that as hard as this has been for us to live through, this type of experience, the Band-Aid is off, and that that needs to happen. Like, if this wound is actually going to heal, we have to suck it up, live through this bullshit of people brazenly, you know, so we all see it. Like, it's not, and so we all believe it, finally. She was saying, like, this has just been a Band-Aid for 100, 300, 400 years of, like, everything's fine. There's a few people who talk like this, and there's microaggressions, but everything's mostly fine. What we're seeing now is that everything has never been fine. And so, again, hard for us, for some of us to live through it, but and to probably raise children during it on some level as well, just to try to negotiate the day. As people of color, as a person of color myself, I deal with it and I keep moving. So it is complicated. I want to I want to take us back to your high school days for a moment, only because I want to try to figure out where your relationship to guitar and music kind of began. For me, I picked high school. For me, it preceded that. But I assume around high school, you start to find yourself. When did you kind of get into... Sorry for presuming anything, by the way, Matt. Maybe you've been...
No problem, man.
But when did you kind of get into music, and when did you get into playing guitar?
I got into music when I was about 5. Pretty much, you know, as long as I can remember. But at 5, I saw the Monkees. I was like, okay, great. That's it, you know. That's the thing. It's like, I'm like really not very, whatever I think about it, I'm like, I'm probably the least interesting, most like closed-minded person, because it's like, I've just had the singular interest in like stupid fucking combo music made by four or five people. Like, I've been interested in that since I was 5 years old.
No,
like,
I'm exactly the same. I was just chatting with someone about this just today over my phone, just saying. I was 6 years old when I first heard a Beatles tape and thought, "What the hell is this?" And
yeah. This is the fucking greatest. Yeah, yeah, it's funny actually. I remember I heard my teacher when I was 6 years old brought in "I Want to Hold Your Hand" and played it and made everybody hold hands, and so I was like, "Ew." and so that song didn't really grab me, but the Monkey,
it sounds like it literally grabbed you. Actually, you had to hold someone's hand.
That song touched me and I moved the fucking to the other side of the room. But Monkees, I was already all in on. So I guess I'm Beatles before Monkees, Monkees before Beatles. But then like when I was 8 years old, I got turned on a kid in my class. This guy, Steve Sheridan, was like, Beatles and Queen are cool. I was like, oh, what are those? You know, like, or what's that? Yeah, you know, I think I'd forgotten. And then got obsessed with the Beatles. We we had to do like a class presentation. And me and Steve Sheridan and this kid, Steve Vinetsky. We did a Beatles, you know, we made cardboard guitars and lip sync to the Beatles. And I remember as we were doing it, I was like, this is the worst fucking idea. Like as we were finally, I was like, oh my God, this, like, I saw everybody just laughing at us and thinking we're the goofiest shit in the world. You know, it was such a disaster. And it was like, you know, this would be 1978. The Beatles were not fucking cool. You know, disco was happening. Grease was happening. You know, and I think we did Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds with cardboard guitars it was this huge rebel. I was like, oh my God, what the fuck? You know, I was so I went from just thinking that we were about to do something and I was going to be the coolest person in the world to realizing in real time in front of people that this was the lamest thing in the world. And then I remember girls like fake chased us around like oh yeah, oh, it's the Beatles, look, oh, we really like you guys.
Hard Day's fucking, Night style.
Yeah, but like making fun of it, ironically, being like, we would never, you guys are losers, you know. So I was pretty into it, and then somehow it took a while to get over the trauma of like, well, I everybody saw me pretend to play guitar and I don't know how to play guitar, but like I think I sort of walked around like I was going to play guitar, or I was a guitar player before I ever did. I already had to play clarinet because also I'm from the generation where it's like, it was just normal to play an instrument, whether you gave a fuck about music or not, you know?
Because of school or because of your parents?
Yeah. Because of school, right? You know, which is awesome. And that's another really interesting thing. And something I think about all the time. It's kind of a separate conversation, but the idea that like being good at music is even special. It's not. It's totally not. It's not special to be good at music. It's like, it's something that everybody can do. And the sounds that come out of your mouth hole and hands when you're good at music, that's special. But the ability to do it is not.
Right.
You know, and it's something that you fucking learn. And it's cool. And it's a really good thing to know how to do. And that used to just be understood because it was good for your brain and good for the environment for people to know how to fucking play a tune. You know what I mean? That's good. That's a good thing. That's a good skill. There's no such thing as somebody knowing how to play a tune. That's always good. You know what I mean? Like it's like somebody knowing how to draw a reasonable, cute drawing of whatever they're looking at. That's good. You know what I mean? Like, you can't say that that's not, you know, like that. And anyone can do that. Literally.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
It just takes education. So.
And time and perseverance.
And time. Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. You know, and all that stuff. But it's just like, that used to be built into the US school system. It's like there was fucking music classes, and pretty much like just so many kids were in school band. They didn't care about, they didn't really even want to be there, you know?
It was forced upon some of us, right?
You know, and there's that, and then there's the counter argument, like, well, you're going to make kids hate music before. So it's like, no, actually, the worst thing that's really going to happen is the kid's going to think that's corny, but they're still going to know how to play, you know what, the beginning of Moonlight Sonata on a piano, and it sounds cool. So that's me with clarinet when I'm 8 years old. Like, oh God, I have to do this with my dad's, because, you know, my dad said I have to play in the school band, and that seems fair enough. My dad's a nice enough guy. He says it's a good idea, so I'll do it. You know what I mean? And so I played clarinet, Jesus, all the way through high school, just because I thought it was just something you had to do. Just kind of an obligation, a school obligation.
Same way you have to learn math or science.
Yeah, totally. Right. Totally. 100%. Yeah. So then the guitar side was a whole other thing. That was fantasy. You know, that was like what I wanted to do and what I aspired to do in a completely, as I've made clear, moronic monkey's childhood way.
You know, Kiss was also, I just want to interject. Yeah. I love the, I don't know how I got to see it. I guess TV was different and things were syndicated. Maybe they still are. The monkey's TV show was remarkable. Like, I was a big fan.
This is fucking cool.
I was a big fan of the Batman, the 60s Batman show. And then I saw the monkeys, and they felt sort of like related. Like, TV was very interesting. It was like meta almost. Like, they were kind of, everything
was,
it was like a joke. And the monkeys were clearly like, they were personalities. The songs were great.
Mm-hmm.
They all lived in a house. Like, I loved that show. Dream of Jeannie too. I remember watching all these shows and feeling like I was in on some kind of joke from like the 60s that I didn't understand. And then things it didn't really happen in the 80s. Like, 80s sitcoms were quite earnest, but then I would always come across like the monkeys was so incredible. But it also turned them into a little bit of a joke, because we didn't take their music as seriously, because they were the guys, they were one of the first boy bands, right? They were a fabricated entity on some level.
Dude. I'm laughing because yes, I agree with you. And also my girlfriend and I last night were having this conversation about the monkeys, literally about this, which is they were hip. They were cool. I don't know how, like my girlfriend, like, I think I was like, oh, did you ever see that movie Head? I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Head.
It's amazing. Yeah, of course.
You know, so I was like, you know, the intro to Head was just such a cool thing. So we watched that. And then she's like, right. And so they're like kind of like the first prefab band. I was like, yeah, but like, I don't know if they were the first, but yes, they're prefabricated, but that was also built in, that was understood, and they played with that. And there was this sense of, you know, it's a different kind of irony, you know, because like it was just hip. They were hip. And also, you know, the more you find out the monkeys, the more amazing they are. You know, they took Hendrix on tour.
Yeah.
You know?
No, like, absolutely. They were cool. That's the weird thing.
Yeah. And Neil Young and Jimi Hendrix are on monkeys tracks. That's something that nobody knows.
I didn't know that.
Because there is some kind of union loophole or something, but I don't know why I'm saying union, but I remember somehow hearing that. But basically, monkeys was a fucking huge payday for a lot of cool people, including musicians. And Hendrix and Neil Young, I was told by somebody who worked with Neil forever, that they sessioned on monkeys tracks.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And they did it because they were like, this fucking, you know, these songs are great. The money's great, you know, and they get anonymously play on it. So there's like, it was cool. Like, there's literally Hendrix and Neil Young, this is what I'm told, are on a couple of monkeys tracks that you know.
Together? Like, together they're on it?
I don't know about that. Probably not.
Neil Young's whole early recorded history, like the stuff with Rick James, and like, he's just got so many interesting connections.
I mean,
to
yeah,
people.
I mean, that guy was such a beast musician.
Yes.
But anyway, like, so the Monkees, I totally agree with you. And for some reason, they were on all the time.
Yeah.
You know? So my brain turns on, you know, 73 or 74, and they were just constantly on TV, you know. So from about the age of 3 to 6, that was my shit, you know. And I'll go on, actually, here's a deeper cut. Sha-na-na.
Yes.
I'm re-evaluating Sha-na-na in a big way. I have before, but I'm like, looking at it now that I'm officially old and out of touch and nothing matters, and my opinion doesn't matter about fucking anything. Sha-na-na is so incredibly cool and was so huge for anybody my age, whether you like it or not, whether we liked it or not. It was they were on TV through the 70s. And then when you start to break it down, it's like Sid Vicious's favorite band was Sha-na-na.
Huh.
You know what I mean? Like, look at Malcolm McLaren, look at the Sex Pistols. They look like they're in Sha-na-na.
Oh, that's,
you know,
interesting.
Not that,
yes,
Sid Vicious was making the calls, but the English were the only people. The English had a grasp of what was fucking rad about 50s rock and roll, and in the 70s. And so there were these movements like the Teddy Boys and Seditionary and Malcolm McLaren. That was all post Teddy Boys. That was all like 50s rock and roll is the shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, don't get it twisted. This is the wildest shit. You know, like this hippie shit of people standing on stage and being self-indulgent. Fuck that. You know.
Yeah.
So Sha-na-na were the only Americans doing that. You know, and they started doing it in 67, I think. And they were a radical group of Columbia University students who were involved in some pretty seriously gnarly protests and then were just into some weird shit. And somehow, because they played at a club called Steve Paul's The Scene, which is another kind of, that's a whole other thing, but there's this really amazing club in New York that is the secret history to so much stuff. Like, meaning, if you played there, your career would take off.
Oh,
and
okay.
Sha-na-na gets a gig at The Scene, which leads to them getting a gig at Woodstock, which leads to ultimately a TV show, you know, in 74 or 75, they have a fucking syndicated TV show, you know, but this is one of the strangest bands ever, you know, and talk about like a sense of being in on something like in fact, this is why I was watching the Monkees, because I was thinking about these things that were omnipresent musical forces that were kind of perceived as at some point in your journey as a music freak, you have to like leave these things behind and somehow, or somebody tells you this is corny, or you just decide, Jesus, I can't watch the Monkees again. They're everywhere. Or I can't watch Sha-na-na anymore because I would need some alternative to this because this is everywhere.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like they were so ubiquitous in a certain way, or they felt ubiquitous rather.
Right.
And so Sha-na-na became this, you know, like was like, at least for me, and it's so funny now because I was saying this to my girlfriend. I was like, you know, it was the opposite in my child mind of Sha-na-na. Kiss was like the cool alternative to Sha-na-na, and she's like, dude, it's the exact same shit. In fact, you know, Sha-na-na is like so much cooler. I was like, I know that now, but like, you know, like then it was like, well, but Kiss had like Blood, and you know, like, you know, and my parents, and actually because Kiss had was so gross that parents would not get behind Kiss, but for some reason, because they thought Sha-na-na was okay, I guess, because I don't know why.
Well, there was no blood. There was no like,
yeah, but I mean,
super
and
long
I guess,
tongue.
Okay, here's the other thing. We're talking about Sha-na-na. No one knows about Sha-na-na now. No one under 40 knows they ever existed, ever.
Right.
Ever. And so, like, I just turned on a kid to school that I know, you know, he was like 25 or something like that. I was like, I just sent him a Sha-na-na clip. He was like, what the fuck is this? You know, like, and just look up, all I can say is look up Sha-na-na 1972, and it will blow your mind. It is so fucking cool and strange. And there's a sense, I guess I'm going on about it, because there's a sense of irony. These guys know what's up. They're very hip.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're in on something, they're in character, but it goes beyond that. There's also so much love for it. They're actually, it's, I don't know, it's fascinating. Like now is a really good time just to check out Sha-na-na.
Well,
and on a bigger level,
yeah,
it's, and on a bigger level, it's interesting to tie it together with this sort of idea of American badassery, individualism, and how it's led to the horrible culture that we're in now, What's so cool about Sha Na Na, it's like 12 dudes. They're all bad guys, right? They're all kind of heely 50s guys. They're all together. They're all working together. There is no front guy. They're all front guys. You know what I mean? Hmm. There is such a fucking unified sense of togetherness that it's like almost, I don't know what, it's really moving, you know? And particularly now when you see it, it feels different than watching a bunch of dancers on stage, like you know, at an award show. It's a whole different thing. I don't know, just watch it. It's like, they're all dancing. They're all singing. Every guy is 100% giving it. Every guy's better than the next guy. You know what I mean?
Well,
but they're all together.
I'm going to look
it
up.
It's really cool.
Sha Na Na, 1972. Dude. I'm going to look it up.
Yeah, man. Look up Sha Na Na Suite in 1972. There's a great like 20-minute thing of them playing some big TV televised festival. And that's the one. They threaten the host. like with the singer, literally threaten. He goes, you hear, and it's off. It's kind of off mic. He goes, I thought you said you were going to move these things out of the way. The guy's like, we're moving them out of the way. He's like, well, you better move them out of the way. We're going to move you. Like, it's incredible. Just dig it. And I could go on for hours more because there's a lot more to talk about Sha Na Na. But anyway, going back to what I was into as a kid, fucking Sha Na Na, it wasn't even whether you're into it or not. It was like what you had to watch. You know?
Yeah. Like,
it was
on.
But like, again, going back to it, it's like, it's so aggressive. It's somehow not sexual, even though it's like so much man ass and cock, like in your face, like these tight pants, and like it's really intense.
Right.
But somehow the sexuality is just part of it. It's not a thing. I don't know. It's really fascinating if you watch it now. Also, like aggressive baldness, like mixed with guys dressed as teenagers. It's so weird, but it really works, you know, like I don't know, just check it. It's really
cross-generational appeal there, I guess, is what's going
on. It's just some wild shit, you know. But really, mainly on like a style thing, it's like they look so fucking cool, it's nuts, you know.
Awesome.
and they sing so good, and there's something so punk about the whole thing, I guess. In closing, there's something so non-pretentious, and you feel like you could be in it. You feel like you could do it somehow.
Yeah,
you know?
I think when people come across self-aware and are clearly having fun with something, it is infectious. Mm-hmm. It's more infectious than people who aren't aware of what they're doing, like who don't realize what mm-hmm. they're really putting out there, which is mm-hmm. often that's where self-seriousness comes in. You're like, hey, man, chill out a little. Like, you're taking this a little too seriously. It's music.
It's supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
Like, do you know how this is coming off? Because I don't think you did.
Well, I was just watching the video for Break Up Your Band that's available on. Uh-huh. And there's like a male stripper or something going on. What? Like, so you guys had as you went on in your musical career, you have a sense of fun. Like, when I think of also Guitar Moves, the TV show you had. There was a sense of reverence and a sense of fun. Like, I think you've always had that. Like, this is ridiculous. I'm taking this seriously, but also I recognize that this is a bit ridiculous. And maybe that stems from, I'm psychoanalyzing you here.
But
maybe monkeys, Sha Na Na.
Sha Na Na.
You know, I take myself and my work seriously, but I'm having fun and we should have fun. Is that maybe?
Yeah. And this shit is pretty fucking stupid. Like, yeah, I mean, but like, so is everything. Yeah, I don't know. Like, it's profoundly stupid. I don't know.
Well,
I can't argue with it. And again, I'm laughing because that's what I said last time before I went to bed. I was like, well, I guess all my life I knew that one day I'd be this guy being like, yeah, actually, no, Sha Na Na. You know, like,
well, there's it. A, you know, as we're speaking, there's a, I just followed the Super Wolves Instagram account, and there was there's a video clip, and it's you playing guitar. It's a split screen, and the one side is black, and it's you playing guitar, and then Will Oldham shows up, and kind of just as he starts singing. And that has, I know that has like a bit of a comedic effect. And I feel like Will has that too, where Will is having fun with reverence, having fun with seriousness on some level. And I feel
totally.
Like, is that?
Yeah, I think you're, I agree with you. I think that the cool, I think nobody touches Will is in this aspect, which is that there's this intense sense of fun, like really funny. And then also, but it's like sort of sitting by the sitting by a yawning grave, you know, like, you know, like he really genuinely, I think almost everything he does has a sense of humor and a real sense of like an understanding of the hard parts of life and death, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. And like, that's, he really trucks in that really beautifully and really well. And it's it's consistent. Yes. In his work from the jump, you know, and like I picked up on it right away and responded to it when I first heard that music, and you know, but yes, there's always something kind of funny about it, you know, like and it puts Will in a certain place, and definitely it puts what Will and I do together in a certain place, which to me I like, and it's funny because me and Will can really, really, really connect on things. I mean, that's why we do what we do. But like, when I told Will that I've been watching Sean and I, and he was like, "Oh my god!" He's like, "I watched that all the time. I haven't reconsidered it." You know, like,
okay, you're spreading the word of Sean and I. You're like the president of the Sean and I fan club.
I had to, especially with people that I'm close that I work closely with. It's like you kind of got to bring it up. You know? but what's wild is that me and Will have talked about everything for the last 20 years, and we somehow never talked about that. And it's foundational.
Yeah.
You know, it is, you know, but again, it is something that was so foundational and something that I watched as a kid was such a sophisticated, ironic take on rock music from the 50s, you know. It's so wild. It's so weird.
Well, it is. And I mean, yeah, Will and I have become friendly over the last 15 years or so, and mm-hmm. he's always very sweet to me and grants me time, and I think we have mm-hmm. really interesting and far-flung conversations, not unlike this one, if I might say, Matt. Like, mm-hmm. we kind of started cool. one place and went a different way, but I do want to delve into this relationship a bit more. You mentioned you've been working together for 20 years. How did you and Will actually connect? You said you were a fan of his music first. How did you connect as collaborators? And then within that, how is this extended? Like, you guys now call yourselves, you made a record called Superwolf, and mm-hmm. Will makes lots of records with lots of people, but something mm-hmm. about this spark between you has sustained itself in a mm-hmm. way that is a little unusual for him. And you call yourselves now, I think, Super Wolves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is the nature? Yeah. Can you talk about the origin of this relationship and why it seems to continue?
I think I could try to get that through that pretty clearly. I met Will through a mutual friend, through Britt Walford, who is drummer of Slint, mm-hmm. who Will grew up with. And in the 90s, Britt and I ended up as roommates in this weird Bowery loft. And I was playing a little bit of music with Britt and kind of hoping that me and Britt were going to start playing more music. So, and then one summer Will moved to New York, and we ran into each other on the street because we literally just stopped, you know, we recognized each other and we were like, "Hey, you're Britt's friend. You're friends with Britt." You know what I mean? And so we just started talking on Houston Street in New York. So we ended up getting drinks with Britt, and David Berman was also living in New York at the time. Mm. And so we just hung out, you know, we just kind of hit it off right away. And then also what was funny is then right around that same time, or maybe it was after, it's hard for me to remember, Will ended up hiring the PR company that I worked at. He didn't hire me, but he ended up hiring another publicist of this PR company that I worked at to work on I See a Darkness.
Oh.
So, and I really don't remember what conversation happened first, but I guess the one that really mattered was that we met on the street and it was about our mutual friend. But another very interesting thing was that I got to know Will as a friend, but then also he would come by the office, you know, and it was, you know, in the 90s, like he had his mystique was massive.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And so so all of a sudden there are these advanced cassettes of Bonnie Prince Billy. And I was like, "What the fuck is this?" You know? Mm-hmm. And also and that record blew my mind. And I was like, "Wait, so this is Will? This is Palace Brothers guy? What is this? What is this? You know?" Mm-hmm. Well, he's calling himself Bonnie Prince Billy, right? Oh, here he is. So Will walks in. I was like, "Hey," you know. I was like, why are you Bonnie Prince Billy? And he goes, oh, I'm trying to lose my fans. I'm trying to lose my fan base. That was his line, and which is a very memorable, hilarious. And again, I'm sitting at a desk in a PR office. I was like, this guy's sick, you know, but it was interesting. So we kind of like hit the ground running between sort of, he had made a pivotal record and I kind of got to have a couple of conversations with him, like I'm Bonnie, you know, talking about him saying I'm Bonnie Prince Billy now. And I mean, I can't think of too many people who, you know, Palace had, Will Oldham and Palace really had money, value.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
at the time. And he definitely was not interested in that, you know? Hmm. So anyway, so that was an interesting conversation. But then we're just friends with Britt and we're hanging out and laughing. He's fucking just getting wasted and having fun. And then he heard me play guitar. And by that point, I had kind of turned a corner and I started finger picking. And Chavez wasn't doing much. And I had kind of just taken an intense interest in learning how to finger pick. And he heard me play. And he goes, and he goes, oh, wow, you sound good. I was like, okay, cool. He goes, you want to record? And I was like, sure. and then he's like, well, I got the song. You want to try the song? Sure. And he kind of shows it to me. And I use my finger picking thing that I just figured out. He goes, yeah, man, like let's record this. You know, I was like, oh, so I was like, you know, my friend Khan has a studio. He's like, let's do that. He's who's he? He's like, he's a techno guy. He's like, oh, really? I was like, yeah. He's like, want to see if we can record with a techno guy, you know? So we recorded with this guy, Khan, who's amazing. Khan Orel. He's pretty deep, serious, real techno dude from Berlin.
Okay.
He made records and making records for Matador. But his whole thing, he was always a guy who like was very into like the human face of techno.
Oh, okay.
But at any rate, we ended up making a, you know, a folky kind of song, but we recorded it with a guy who never recorded folky stuff. And it was just a really cool experience. And then from then on, I was like, you know, that was it. I was going to be playing, I would play with Will whenever I could.
So what song are you referring to?
That song is called What's Wrong with the Zoo.
Okay.
And it was on some French soundtrack.
Oh, it's a bit of an obscurity. Okay.
Well, my God, totally. Yeah. And then I've never even heard it. I mean, I remember hearing it when we did it. I don't know if I've ever heard it since.
He's very hard to keep up with, Will, isn't he?
There's just
always something which I appreciate, actually. I like.
Me too. I think it's awesome.
I like not knowing. I feel it's usually a few months later. I'm like, what? I just look at something. I'm like, oh, I didn't realize that was a thing. And then I find it and I'm like, oh, another amazing record or song. Yeah. He's.
He's always working. He's a workaholic, that's the wrong word. He's always working. He's not addicted to. He's not a workaholic, but he loves to fucking work. That loves it.
Really does. There's nothing pejorative to me. It's inspiring. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what it does to him. And
I guess when I say workaholic, that implies like some kind of fucked upness about what you're doing.
No, I get it. Yeah.
But that's why I redacted, because it's actually, you know, Will's a wild dude. Like, we're all wild people, but I think, and this is also something that hit me right away about him, was like, there's nothing weird about this guy as far as his work goes. He is about it. You know what I mean? Like he's about fucking writing. He's about singing. He's a singer and a songwriter. Like, that's what he does, you know? And that's what he does every fucking day, you know? The clarity of that was really striking, you know? And which is also what's funny about him, I suppose, is also like, it's like, well, then why does he change his name all the time? Why does he seem to not care about being famous? Why does he, you know, like, why is he such a conundrum? Why, you know, like why does he do all these things that maybe somebody who was trying to be a brand or whatever wouldn't do? You know what I mean? And the answer is because he's a singer and a songwriter. You know what I mean?
Well, I think he also once explained to me I asked him why he tended to revisit his older songs so much. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we could loosely describe them as, I think I did in an interview say, yeah, you're kind of doing covers of yourself. He's like, no, no, these are separate universes. These are not, they're not the same. Like, it's from a different, and I said, what?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, like the Justice League, you know, how there's like parallel universes. And I read comic books as a kid, but I didn't really follow. I was like, I guess so. And then he explained it. And once you look at Will and his monikers and his records and the fact that he himself has recorded 1,000 versions of I See a Darkness or New Partner, you realize these are separate universes because each day is part of a different universe and each year is a new universe. So if you look at it that way as a temporal sort of recognition or something, I don't think I just think he's on a plane that we don't. He's a gift to me. Like, to me, he's a gift, and he's been a gift in my life since I first encountered him, his work. And
well said.
And having gotten to know him a little bit just through conversations, yeah, he's a gift. And so I do also appreciate you seem drawn to people who want to work. The other collaboration that I find fascinating for you, I mean, there's been so many, but LP, Run the Jewels. Mm-hmm. You appear on, I believe, every Run the Jewels record, right?
I guess it somehow did. Yeah.
So that's just another relationship I'm curious about, because you mentioned this techno fellow, and I'm sure we're all open-minded music people, people who like music. We listen to all sorts of things, and I'm not surprised that you're on working with LP. But how did that relationship start, and why, Matt, are you on every single Run the Jewels record? One would be something, but you're on all four of them so far. How is this possible?
Yeah, well, because I've known LP since the 90s. I mean, one thing that's important to understand, I guess, or I don't know, it's not important, but like, you know, I've lived in fucking New York this whole time, and people come through, and Jamie's from New York, you know what I mean?
Yes, yeah.
And there's just a thing, like, you get to know a lot of people in New York, you know, or at least I sure did, you know, like, it's like people come through there and they're kind of down to hang out and talk about music and hang out at a bar and get drunk and talk, you know, and that's literally now. I know Jamie from going to this bar, Black Betty in Brooklyn. We had a mutual friend who, I guess our mutual friend was his manager, Amici, who I just knew was like a music. I don't even, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was like a friend or friend, but again, there's two different ways about it. It was like, I knew Jamie from talking to him at a bar, but also I was a fan of his shit. And I was a fan of Company Flow. Mm-hmm. And because I worked at this PR company, I turned the Beastie Boys onto Company Flow. And so I ended up getting Company Flow opening slots for the Beastie Boys. So that's also, so it's sort of two different things. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's all very New York. It's very New York-y, you know? And it's funny also, again, with my relationship with Will, I met him on the street, but also I knew him because I worked at a PR, I knew him another way from working at a PR company. So I guess the short answer is New York is a pretty small place. Going back to Will, just to finish up on that, because I think you had, and then, so I started playing with him and stuff, and then the Super Bowl thing and why that's that and why it has a kind of a different thing than everything else, I guess, in this catalog, is because of what the nature of that music is, which is that I do the music, you know?
You're not contributing lyrics, or you do sing.
No, although there actually is at least one Super Bowl song where we reversed it, where I sent him a lyric and then he came up with the chords and melody.
Do you remember which one that is?
Yeah, it's called I Must Be Blind. But in general, just because, you know, sort of how we work, it started with Will. He just wrote me, or he said, hey, I got this really big solo show in London. Would you want to maybe play a few songs with me? Because we'd have this experience at some point on tour. How do I tell this? Some point, we ended up playing a couple of shows with an unrehearsed band. And it was clear that one of the members really didn't know the songs and loved to play, just loved playing. And so it sucked. And so we didn't want to diss the guy. So it eventually came down to, hey, we have an idea. We're just going to do a couple songs where it's just me singing and Matt playing guitar.
Right.
And, you know, and that way the whole band sat out and nobody's feelings were hurt, you know. And I remember it was in Ireland, I guess.
I'm a drummer. So my drummer, uh-huh. my drummer antenna has gone up a little bit. Was it a drummer causing the problem?
It wasn't.
Oh, but, okay, good. Sorry, it's just a drummer sensitivity.
That's usually where it starts. You know?
It does. That's why I wondered.
you know, it's funny. I talk about this a lot, but my grandmother was really into music, and she would always talk about how important accompanists are. And so whenever I play her stuff, she'd be like, well, yes, that's a good song, but why is there always this damn banging on top of all these songs that you listen to? And then by the time I was in high school, I finally got it. I was like, oh, right. I mean, she's really right. Like, these drums don't need to be here. They're like, and I imagine how she heard all music, which is like, well, I guess these days people listen to songs and then there's this redundant banging on top of it. It's really hilarious. It fundamentally changed the way I listen to music. And maybe really sense it really did. That's why Chavez has like big parts where there's no bass or yeah. even there's no drums or whatever was. It's just the whole idea of like make it count, you know.
Well,
or don't play.
I've been listening. Obviously, the reissue of "Gone Glimmering" by Matador just came out relatively recently, and mm-hmm. I was really astonished by that dynamic intent of like this is just going to be drums and guitar, then the second guitar for a little bit, then the bass, but then it's all gone again. That seemed that was a conscious thing in that band.
1,000% Yeah. Yeah, because it was just like, well, why, you know, how do we make it sound interesting and bring it before? And also, it's been done before, but like, weirdly, actually, going back to stupid stuff, Kiss would do it a fair amount. Like, there's an amazing song called King of the Nighttime World. And just check that song out. It's really good. And they didn't even write it. I think Kim Fowley wrote it. But the arrangement is the thing. There's no bass in the whole until the first chorus. And it's fucking awesome. Even just dumb shit like, so one of the things with Chavez was, we're jumping around.
Sorry, Matt.
It's great. That's how my mind works anyway. But one of the things about Chavez was our point, or one of our points was like, you know, some of the 70s rock shit was really wild and radical. Some things that maybe might be perceived as maybe classic rock or whatever were a lot stranger and wilder and more kind of dark and spooky and just cool. And these are kind of conversations that we'd have, and I want to give a good example now of it. I just fucking had it in my mind. God damn it. oh man. Oh yeah. Well, okay. Well, here's an obvious one. And this is actually one that Chavez never talked about, but like that song, Baba O'Reilly, which is like a Who song.
By the Who? You know, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Teenage Wasteland. Yeah, of course. You know, whatever that song.
Yeah.
Dude, that's one of the strangest fucking songs. It is so it's, first of all, it's a Terry Riley ripoff,
right?
You know, so it starts out with a Terry Riley pattern, and then which speeds up and slows down. Then there's piano. The guitar doesn't come in until like 2 minutes, which is like you don't think about that, you know. And the bomb,
three chords. Is it three chords? Yeah.
And dude, that doesn't come in forever. Also, it's just a guitar, and it's way. Not big. It's not big. You know how in our mind, that song is like huge sounding, right?
Well,
when you listen to it,
Pete Townsend. You were talking about Neil Young, who I often think when he gets going, I feel like Neil Young looks like his guitar sounds.
Yeah, totally.
And Pete Townsend with the windmills would make things seem. If I'm correct,
so much bigger.
If you picture the very famous televised,
the
I think
white
it's a.
Suit.
Yeah, the various performances of that song that have been sort of captured, he just is losing his mind. He can't keep still. Yeah. And you're right. He, in a sense, is barely doing anything.
And it's just like when you listen to it, and also like it's incredible. And when the drums come in, they start and then they speed up and slow down really significantly.
Yeah.
And then the bass doesn't come in forever, you know, and everything about that song is fucking weird. And then there's a fucking shitty gypsy violin solo, like, you know what I mean, like, and this is called classic rock, you know. It's like there's nothing classic about this, you know. This is weird. You know, and like and exciting and things are everything is very featured. Everything has its own lane. You know what I mean? And so, in fact, Chavez never discussed that song, but that's a good example of like, sort of, to my mind, I think also the Chavez guys, like, yeah, let's like we could make it exciting, but still completely be within a rock idiom.
You know,
I suppose.
You know what I'm reminded of is the story about Jaws. The movie Jaws is the story is that the shark doesn't show up till like a third of the way through the film because it wasn't working. You were kind of aware that there was a shark and the whole story was about a shark, but you never saw the shark. I feel like certain aspects of music, when music started to get into post-rock or progressive rock, whatever you want to call it, there was this sense of like, let's build tension. Let's build a little bit of anticipation and suspension. Like, I think that maybe is drawn. It's drama. It's a little bit of drama. And
Full on. And that was a big thing with Clay, in particular with Chavez, who talked about, like, he wants to have high drama riffs and stuff. And Clay's thing was, like, he liked a few, like, modern classical composers. And so he would, you know, Clay was interesting. In Chavez, he would only play through an amplifier. He would only play loud electric rock guitar. He wouldn't practice at home. Hmm. And this is like one of the best guitar players I've ever played with. But it's so wild how stylized and how conceptual Clay was about his approach to guitar, which was like, he like, you know, learned it in high school. Then he went to college and only listened to the Rolling Stones in college for something like 2 years. He would only listen to the Rolling Stones, you know, and then he starts this band Bullet La Volta. And I think that's when it started, where he's like, when I play through a Marshall amp in a rehearsal studio for the sake of coming up with a riff that's going to kick it, you know, with some music that's going to be amazing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, really weird. So I've never heard him play anybody else's music ever. Not once.
Huh.
I've never heard him ever play a lick by anybody else.
Now, are you still, so what is the nature of that band at the moment? I feel like there was a reconvening in, what, 3 years ago, something like that? 4 years
ago? Well, yeah, we did an EP with that. We were hoping to do a whole record. Our drummer just doesn't like to play music anymore. This is the long and the short of it.
Oh, okay.
Right? Which is like, that's it, you know. And we love him, and it's like, doesn't really make any sense to do Chavez music without the drummer, since...
Drumming is fantastic.
He's the best part of the band.
You know, yeah, well, don't like, sell yourself short, but the drumming is fantastic.
But this is sort of even going back to the thing, or my idea of something that's good is like, you really can't, it's just everybody's good. Like
everybody's
working together, yeah. You know, and working off of each other.
Just like Sean Anna.
Yeah, just like Sean Anna.
I believe in bands. I really do believe in bands.
Me too. And
the people.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Me too. So to go back to the Super Bowl thing. So, and I guess that's something me and Will haven't talked about, and Will certainly does amazing work with like Emmett Kelly. You know, who did the same thing with Emmett too, meaning like, here's some lyrics, make a song out of it, you know.
Yeah.
But to go back, so he had this big gig in England, asked me to play, and he said, want to do that thing that we did like we did in Ireland, where, you know, it's just me and you playing. I was like, because really, it was really exciting when we did it. So we can't play with this other guy because the guy's overplaying and we want the set to not suck. So we choose a couple of songs, we do them. And I really remember Will wasn't playing guitar. And that was also a thing. So we wouldn't make the band feel bad. It was like, Will's like, I want to try this thing where I'm not playing guitar and I'm just playing to one instrument. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is totally not actually the case, but we just needed to do something in order to not have this other guy play.
Sure.
And by the way, the guy was awesome. It just wasn't working in the context of the, of whatever we were doing.
Sounds like practices weren't able to happen or something maybe, or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's literally what it was. So we didn't have any rehearsals. But it worked. And I remember it was really exciting just to see Will with no guitar on, just being a singer. I was like, whoa, this is sick, you know? And so when he suggested that for this, he's like, you want to come over to London and do the show with me, we'll do like a set within a set, you know, of me singing and you playing guitar. Like, okay, cool. And then he sends me an email that says, and he's like, and you want to make up some songs with these lyrics and we'll do those songs. I was like, fuck, you know, okay. and those were the first Super Wolf songs. And so we wrote, it was two or three songs, and made a cassette of them. And Will was singing at our friend's wedding in LA. So I remember I made the cassette. I think I mailed him the cassette And then I was like, yeah, we'll meet in L.A. and maybe let's meet in L.A. and we'll go over the songs. And so I remember when we got to L.A., he was like, dude, this shit rules. This is awesome. You know, like, I'm really into this. I was like, oh, fucking cool, you know. So the songs only existed on this cassette, and maybe the cassette got lost. Whatever it was, me and Will once again could not rehearse. And all of a sudden we're playing this fucking huge show in London. It was big. It was like 2,000 seat theater is what it felt like, you know.
Yeah.
And we don't have any time to rehearsing in a hotel room, you know, like, it was so like a dream or kind of like an anxiety nightmare, you know, where I was like, we're playing this music, which these songs are good. And these songs are kind of like, you know, I already knew that we were onto something, but they're fucking not easy to play and whatever. It's nerve wracking to play in front of 2,000 motherfucking English people and, you know, whatever. And I remember actually Lawrence from Domino was there. Like, we're backstage, like, running over the songs, like, okay. And somebody's like, okay, you guys are on now. You know, and then went out and did it, and it worked. But that was sort of the roots of it. That was the roots of the thing. So Will was like, let's do this again. How about I'll send you songs, or I'll send you lyrics. You make up the songs. We meet up. We rehearse that day and then play them that night. You know,
wow. Was it? That's amazing.
So, yeah. So then we did it in Brooklyn with a few more songs. And then we did it in New Orleans with a few more songs. That order could be wrong, but we did it. So there was three, at least. I think that was it. So there were three separate, you know, times that we got together. That it was email, make a recording, send the recording. Very, very, very rough recording. And then get together, tweak them, play them that night. You know, so that was the process. For that album. And then about 5 years ago, Will was like, hey, we should probably do another record, you know?
Right.
And so, but also in between, occasionally he just send me a lyric or if there's an idea. So obviously we're like best friends and shit. So, but there was this 15-year gap between Super Wolf formal projects, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the way it works. And that's why it's different. And which is all to say, I'm a band guy too. And a band is basically two or more, you know, to me makes a band. And this is my band with Will, you know what I mean? To me, that's what Super Wolf is.
Yeah.
You know, can't have one without the other. The whole idea is to make the other guy look good, you know, like this is the band stuff, the band thinking, you know, like when I'm in a band, every time I've been in a band, I'm like, fuck, every one of these guys is awesome. Every one of these people is awesome. And I get to play with them. And it's all about us being this gang nobody sounds like us together, you know? And like, yeah. I love all that shit. That's the fucking best, you know? And it's also totally impossible to do, you know, beyond the ages of what's, you know, 17 to 23, you know, like it's kind of the sweet spot to be able to do that. And even then that implies that you're privileged enough to have space and time to do it, you know. Bands are so special, you know, and they are generally the products of privilege or products of an enormous amount of work and heart, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's some combination of those two things. Like, I'd say that the realest band on the planet that I can think of right now is like a band like Songhoi Blues, you
oh
know,
my God.
Or dudes. You know what I mean?
I saw them. It's one of the, I guess in, I must have been 2019. I saw them twice and total mind blower. I love their record. I love their records beforehand, but to actually see them. Now you have been working with them. Is that correct?
Yeah, dude, check the new album. If you like them live, check the new album. It was like the record I produced it. So we made the record that they should have made all along, I think.
Okay. Not to disparage their previous records or EPs. I think they're great. I love all their music. But also, yeah.
No, totally. And also, I didn't want to disparage those records because they had to make those records to get to this point.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was very, you know, like that those records got them a shitload of attention and they were about working with famous people and, you know, the Blur guy and whoever, and you know,
Iggy sings a song. Yeah. Iggy Pop.
Iggy's on there. But that was about, you know, that had again, it's great that they got to this point where they could go in and make like a really gnarly live sounding record.
No, this is what this record is. That's exciting, and they're the best. And when Iggy was on this show, when I talked to Iggy, he told me that he found out about them because he played them on his BBC show, and then they just found out about each other, and that's how he ended up collaborating with them, which I just thought
was... Yeah, totally. Yeah, no, dude, fucking Iggy's the coolest. Yeah, he just did it because he thought it was cool, you know, and but also, and I'm sure that it helped that the narrative had to do with the Blur guy, you know, like...
Yeah, yeah.
It's such an interesting story because it goes all the way back to... This is the realest band in the world because these guys are actually fucked and they're refugees and they, you know, they had nothing but each other and, you know, and all that stuff. That's all true, you know. But then they get colonized in the, you know, by the guy from
Blur,
who has the balls to go over to Africa to do a talent show, as far as I can tell.
Is that what happened? It's like, oh, I didn't know that.
That's, I think so, isn't it? I mean, by the way, I love everybody. I love everybody and everything, but still, it was like it was like, wait, let me get this straight. You're the guy from Blur. You go over to Mali to decide who's good and do like a talent show and then pull out the best ones. I think that's and then they get to record with your Western ass. You know, like
that is, you know, like, that is a new form of colonization for sure.
Oh yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. But. You know, you got to be smart about this. It's like, yeah, fuck yeah. However, whatever it takes, you know, like for these guys. So, and that's all I mean by the record, you know, aesthetically, these guys had to do what they had to do in order to get their message across, which meant, you know, signing to an English label. And of course these guys fucking, they're so psyched, you know, to collaborate with people, you know,
we're heading down a road here where, and it's a whole other episode of this show probably, but we're heading down the road of like, was Alan Lomax good? Was he actually a good person for?
He was. Well, you know what I mean?
I'm just trying to tie the two together. Like, yes, well, that sucks.
Get Nathan Salzberg. Do an episode with Nathan Salzberg.
Oh, I'd love to
have that.
I'd love to.
Because he worked with the Lomax Foundation, and he could give a great answer to that.
Please connect us, Matt. I would love to do that.
My pleasure.
Yeah,
it would be my pleasure. But ultimately, yeah, these questions, and I guess this is fun. I was talking to somebody in New York who's like, you know, he's a cool guy, and he was kind of like, oh, you know, I like M.D. Mokhtar, the not Songhoi Blues, because one's realer than the other, and you're like, dude, please, like, oh my god, And then if you're actually going to go and judge things by that, then Songhoi Blues are the best band that ever existed. You know? Like if you're going to go by like what you think is, you know, like what the individuals are and what their reasons for doing things are, what's credibility or whatever, authenticity, I guess is the word. I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Like fucking come on, you know, but it's interesting how, I guess, Songhoi Blues are just an interesting band. I'm getting off the point, but they are an example to me of a band where they're fucking down for each other.
Yeah.
They are so down for each other. You know, they really are. And I mean it, they really are. And there's other bands that I love, and particularly African bands. A lot of times bands are down for the music, you know, and there's an understanding that the music is the thing and we're going to play this music. But oftentimes, there's just musicians, I guess, which is like, you know, it's like, yeah, but it's all about me.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah. No, I like,
but something like Songhoi Blues, it's so fucking cool how they work together and how they support each other as musicians and as a musical entity. So something like with what I do with Will, it's the same thing. It's like, fucking, I think this guy fucking rules. And I think that I could bring something to it. It's like, okay, so I have a guy who writes great lyrics and has this incredible voice, you know, like, so, and that allows me, that's a huge responsibility for me to come up with a fucking melody for this voice to sing and then come up with music that is going to hold, you know, that's going to make it fucking, you know, awesome. You know, I don't know, and it's so great that I don't know, there's nobody else. And for some reason, Will's lyrics and voice are such that I seem like I it just makes me do it. It somehow brings out writing in me that is that to my mind is stuff that I like to hear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It also allows me, this is the other really great thing. And this is why I advise anybody who fucks with music is like, just get a partner and have them just send you lyrics and you write the song, you know, like try that. Cause guess what? People used to do it all the time and it really works really well. You know, it allows me to get out of the way of myself, you know, and come up with things that maybe if I thought I was going to have to sing them, I wouldn't. I don't know. You know, like for me, I could be very neurotic and self-editing even as a fucking old person. I should be so far past this, you know what I mean? But sure. but I still am not. So I'm much harder, you know, that's why I don't do solo records. I just get annoyed with myself and just, I'm like, you know what? I just don't want to hear this, you know? So, I don't have the imagination for a listener who would want to hear this, but being able to work with Will, it's great. I'm like, I want everybody to hear this. You know what I mean? Like it gives me confidence and gives direction and also precludes my self-editing negativity negativity works towards a positive thing. Cause it's like, I have to deliver this song eventually.
Yeah.
You know? So cause Will fucking worked on it.
I love the threads of talent and happenstance and friendship and authenticity mm-hmm. that we've been covering throughout mm-hmm. this conversation. Like just, I think, and sort of the nature of the collective good. I feel like we started.
Totally, man.
I feel like that's all swimming around here. And I appreciate that. Now, this is going to be a weird wrap-up question for you, Matt, because I don't know how to keep track of everything you do. Can you talk about what's coming up next for you, per se? Is there anything you can talk about?
Well, I mean, I believe all hellscapes to the side, you know.
Sure,
me and Will have some exciting stuff coming up for sure that we've been working on, and I'm remiss. I fucking hate it because we're having such a fun conversation, but I'm remiss to give like it's such a big deal. Yeah, me and Will have cured COVID, but I can't tell you anything about it. we've been working on a lot of stuff, and we've been beating it into shape. And so 2020, there will be more music with me and Will coming out.
2020,
I can safely say.
2021.
Oh, 2021. Oh my God. Yeah.
Please don't jinx us. I don't want to ruin this year.
Sorry, dude. So hellscapes aside, I'm looking forward to doing stuff with Will this year in 2021. And then what? I feel like it's fucking something else that I've been looking forward to coming out.
Well, you mentioned the Songhai Blues thing, which is a production you're involved in, and I assume.
Yeah. But that record came out. I'm going to make another record with them. We loved that. Let me see. Okay, I produced an album for Garcia Peoples that turned out great. I have no idea where that's going to come out, but that should come out this year. I'm going to make another record with Songhai Blues. I'm going to make another record with Country Westerns. This is just production stuff.
Yeah.
Or not just production stuff, but this is production stuff. And then Superwolf stuff for sure. I hope that, you know, me and Steve Malcolm, Steve Malcolm made a record where he kind of,
that's right.
You used me on that. And that all, you know, we had a lot of touring planned for 2020 that didn't happen. And so I'm imagining that we'll be doing some degree of stuff. Again, this is all the hellscape-y shit.
Right. Was this for the Traditional Techniques record?
Yeah,
right. I remember seeing videos that you were going to be in that band. Yeah. That's great. Stevens, I'm a huge fan of Stevens as well. So that's.
Oh, he's so great.
Yeah.
Have you had him on the show?
He's been on a couple of times. Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Yeah.
Love Steven.
Yeah. He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's best. But and what else? I did a thing. Did a really exciting recording with Iggy Pop. Really exciting.
Oh, it's probably, awesome.
And it's just a song, but that'll be part of a bigger Velvet Underground related thing.
Wow.
That I have no idea what's going on with it, but I know that it's coming out at some point this year and everybody will hear about it. It's definitely not for me to break the news, but me and Iggy did it. That is fucking sick, in my opinion, what we did.
Potentially related to the documentary, maybe?
It's related to.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me fucking too. I'm dying. This, you know, that's why I'm sounding so weird about stuff. It's like, man, this COVID shit, man, it's just really hard because I don't want to.
Yeah, you never know what's actually going to happen, right?
Everything keeps on shifting around so much, but and it's really frustrating, as you can imagine. I'm sure it's been frustrating for you too,
It's been horrible and sad and all those things, but there's also been the great gift of time for some of us. Like as a parent,
for sure.
Not rushing around as much between my work and my, you know, feeding children and being with them and all that stuff. So yeah, there's little gifts in it, and trying to contemplate, or rather focus my energy on celebrating the time we have. We've kind of gotten back a little bit, and so we'll see what happens when things are a bit more normal, because there's aspects of normal that I don't want to return to. And I know...
Fucking A, dude. right? Right? That's the thing. It's like, shit was sucking so hard in many ways. So, like, so I do have some hope for you know, things being different in a cooler way, for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, like, yeah, so I was saying, it was like, man, all these venues are closing. I was like, ah, most of them sucked anyway. That's a terrible thing. It's so bad to say, because I can't even speak to the things that we've lost, because I can't speak to it. It's just, it's too devastating. But on the other hand, there's a lot of whack venues. There's a lot of bullshit going on.
Absolutely, like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I'm not begrudging the ones that did a great job and treated people well, but some of it did need to go somehow. And
hell yeah,
or at least be reminded that we can function without them or something. I don't know. There's just there's something going on there that, again, I don't want to disparage anyone, because it's hard for all of us. I do miss going to see a show, and hopefully Matt Sweeney's on stage in front of me, as opposed to on some sort of screen, you know, like I do want that stuff back. I'm just, anyway,
me too.
So
I hear that.
Okay. So Matt, if people want to keep tabs on you and your happenings and doings via internet stuff or what have you, where would you like to send them per se?
Go to keep your eyes on thesuperwolves.com or whatever. No, it's thesuperwolves on the Instagrams.
Yes.
Keep an eye on that's THEE Superwolves. And, you know, I'm the heavy jams with a Z. Just go on the Instagrams. That's sort of
Instagram is
where I hang out and kind of low key promote my shit. That's the best way to know what's going on.
Now, given that we've talked about so many things and so many collaborations here, normally on the show we go out on a song, and I actually wondered if you might want to choose something that you and Will did, because there have been some recent singles, and this thing that Will's doing with Bill Callahan is quite incredible, but is there something that you appeared on recently that we can maybe play for people?
Yeah, dude, play Make Worry for me. We put it out as a single and a video a couple of weeks ago on Drag City. It's Super Wolves, or I don't know. It's Matt Sweeney, Bonnie Prince Billy.
Yeah.
At Super Wolves, and the song is called Make Worry for Me, and we recorded it on Valentine's Day of 2020 in Nashville with Pete Townsend on drums. That's the real Pete Townsend, not the English one.
The English one is a figment of our imagination.
He's an aberration.
Windmilling.
The real one is. I don't know who that guy is. What did I say about Bob? Whatever. Pete Townsend, who played drums on the first Super Wolf record, is a guy that we love and a musician that we love. Is on drums, and then I'm playing everything else. I'm trying to think of some other interesting things I could say about it. But let me see. It was recorded in Nashville at our favorite studio, which is no longer there, which is a studio called The Butcher Shop, which had some high profile love from Sturgill Simpson, because he made that big record that he did called The Butcher Shop Sessions. But it was a really, really cool studio. And I think that song, Make Worry for Me, is in some ways also sort of is a loving example of how fucking cool that studio sounds.
It's
so
a gorgeous recording. Oh, yeah. I was playing it in the living room for my family yesterday, as a matter of fact, and my wife in particular thought it was quite lovely. So, and it is it is available via Drag City, as you say. So let's go out on that then. This is Matt Sweeney and Bonnie Prince Billy with Make Worry for Me. Matt, this was a tremendous pleasure. I hope you enjoyed yourself. Thank you for the time and best of luck with everything.
Thank you. Yeah. So lovely talking to you, man. Really, really. I appreciate it. Really. Very, very nice. And makes me feel not crazy. So it's good to talk to you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks again to Matt Sweeney for appearing on this, the 591st episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network. And is available wherever it is that you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about, you're looking for it and you can't find it, or if you want to learn more about me, sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit my website, vishkana.com. Everything you need to know about this show and some things about me are all, it's all there, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly at Vish Khanna. You can also follow me on Instagram at Vish Khanna as well if you'd like. I'm on there doing stuff sometimes. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, please message me on Patreon and I will get you a t-shirt while supplies last. I still have some. So yeah, $6 or more. But again, you can, whatever it is you can afford, and you can always change it. If you started at six and you want to go down to four or three or two or one or zero, I mean, really you have all the options in the world. You can also go up. You start at six, you go to 10. Why not? If you like the show, whatever you want to do, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to liveatmasseyhall.com, where you can watch beautifully captured concerts by great Canadian artists. And also to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, too, to Jim Guthrie for letting me use the instrumental version of his song, The Rest Is Yet to Come, to end this show every week. You can hear it right now, faintly. I'll raise it later. I'll fade it up so you can hear a bit more of it. You can learn more about Jim and all of his work at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Matt Sweeney and for subscribing to this podcast and asking your friends to do the same. Anything you can do to spread the word about the show is meaningful and helpful. So thank you. And I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.